Welcome, listener, to Season 3 of the Fictoplasm Podcast. This season, we're going to try a few new things. We're going to read into genre, we're going to interview some really interesting people, but there'll also be plenty of books for us to pick apart and choose our best bits for role-playing material. Now, it's Halloween, so our first episode is Werewolves. Hello and welcome to Fictoplasm. I'm joined by Liz.
Hello.
And Becky.
Hi.
And we're going to do something. This is going to be the first of what may be an occasional episode format, which is we revisit previous works that we've looked at. And instead of looking at one book, we're going to look at the whole genre. This episode is going to focus on werewolves, which is thematically appropriate given that it should be going out on October the 31st. First of all, I'll go over to Liz to introduce the concept and the scope of what we're doing.
Sure. So you mentioned that we're revisiting an earlier work. So we're talking partly about, or Becky will be talking later, about the Kelly Armstrong works. So that's our link back to an earlier one. We're going to be looking at film and TV, as well as our usual focus on books, talking about the werewolf genre quite widely, each of us bringing in some of our particular favourite examples. And of course, as always, we're also going to be looking at the way werewolves operate in RPGs.
Thanks, Liz. So I think then the first thing we're going to cover is books. Becky, would you like to take it away?
I'd love to. My favourite werewolf stories are primarily modern werewolf fiction, and the features of that is it tends to be some sort of urban fantasy or urban supernatural tale, and it usually has sexy and or romantic werewolves in. And I think part of the reason that this particular subgenre of werewolves resonates a lot with me is it's written quite exclusively by women, pretty much. It anthropomorphizes the werewolves an awful lot and draws out a lot more of the themes which are extant in werewolf fiction across the board. Humanity versus bestiality, animal instincts, dominance and power plays. But it starts to look at them from different angles, which I think is very interesting. So when I talk about werewolves in books, I'm looking at it with a particular kind of a subgenre, I suppose, in mind, the anthropomorphized werewolf as a species, rather than the werewolf fiction, I think, of the early 1920s and 1930s, written by Algernon Blackwood, H. Warner Munn, and similar, which, interestingly, the really early werewolf fiction is written almost exclusively by men. So there's clearly kind of been a real shift, I think, in the genre, which is quite interesting. and so my sort of favourite authors writing in the werewolf style or writing about werewolves are obviously Kelly Armstrong, who's influenced me a great deal, but also I'm a big fan of Patricia Briggs. I like Gail Carriage's work. There's also other writers that I haven't yet looked at, like Tanya Huff, I think, has done an interesting werewolf book.
She has.
Yeah, I think she could, I can't remember what it's called. Is it called The Silvered or something like that, which I haven't read? But I suppose that if I had to go right back to the beginning of what made me interested in werewolves and looking at werewolves through the eyes of women, it would probably be with Angela Carter. And I can't believe how long it's been since I last read Angela Carter's The Bloody Chamber, which is her feminist reworking of a variety of different fairy tales. But the werewolf in The Bloody Chamber, which is her reworking of Little Red Riding Hood, is a really, I think, quite a seminal work that maybe starts this shift in how we're looking at werewolves. If there is anybody out there, if there's one book that I'm going to tell anybody to read, if there's anybody out there who hasn't managed to read Angela Carter's The Bloody Chamber, then get you to a library now.
To my shame, I have not read Angela Carter's The Bloody Chamber.
Get you to a library now.
I don't know how it's even possible, but I haven't.
Surely you've read it by some sort of cultural osmosis, Liz.
You'd think that, wouldn't you?
I would. So given that I've got a particular kind of subgenre slant on this, I wondered, Ralph and Liz, what sort of werewolf stuff you've been checking out.
In preparation for this, I reread one book and finished under duress another one, which was the one I reread, which is one I've read before, is Darker Than You Think by Jack Williamson, which is an interesting, I think, around 1940s, late 1940s publication, about, and it's a very sort of fast-paced, pulpy, although I'm not sure it was actually published in the pulps, but I could be wrong, take on the vampire myth, take on werewolves, which is, it's less about werewolves per se and more about a shape-shifting other race. And one of the things that makes it very interesting is that there's this whole stuff about about the discovery of this other ancient race of werewolves, which is running parallel to humanity and is physically and spiritually superior. There's also this stuff about grasping the probabilities of things happening and causing accidents. So there's a sort of the metaphor for some of the accidents that happened to this group of people who've uncovered this sarcophagus the protagonist thinks that they are hunting them down and squeezing the life out of them as in a giant snake form or ripping them to shreds as a wolf. What actually happens is a series of accidents. So you've got this whole thing about this individual who thinks they're transforming into creatures, but actually also wonders if they're actually completely insane. And that in itself is very interesting and horrific because it is this stalking monstrosity of the werewolf stalking the victims, but at the same time you have a great deal of sympathy with the character, and it is an interesting mythology, very nicely written and fast paced. So I enjoyed that. The other one I read was Hemlock Grove, which it's got a great cover, and if I'd stopped there, I think I would have a better opinion of it. It's basically a reworking of everything that is tiresome and bad on modern genre urban horror stuff. It could be a lot better about werewolves than it is. It talks about Vargulfs and Upirs and all these other massively affected Middle European names for supernatural creatures and stuff like that. But mostly it's just written in a very tiresome style. It's more entertaining to watch it on Netflix, but not much. So I will talk about a couple of things later about the cinematic transformation scenes and stuff like that, but I'll leave it at that. That's not a recommend for anything. There's not actually that much werewolf stuff in it. Anyway, Liz?
So I've read the Kelly Armstrong that Becky has read as well, of course. And I've read a bit of Gail Carriger, but my main other werewolf in books series is Anita Blake, which, like Anita Blake, but it's a very long series by Laurel K. Hamilton, has quite a lot in common with the Kelly Armstrong series in that there's a quite thoroughly worked out world with a number of different supernatural races. There are vampires and different things in there as well. Anita Blake has lots of wares, so she has wolves and leopards and God only knows what else. I can't remember all of them. But unlike where Kelly Armstrong, her depiction of the werewolves and the various supernatural races gets better and more interesting, more nuanced as they go along, the Anita Blake books become more and more about sex as they go along. So at the beginning, we have something like 90% plot and 10% sex. And at about the point I gave up, somewhere around book 13, that ratio had reversed. And I assume that if they're still going, there will be no plot left in them anymore at all. And there'll just be one long, complicated sex scene with lots of different were-animals. Also not really a recommendation. But very much in the vein of books that you're talking about, Becky, the sexy and or romantic werewolves in books written by women in that urban fantasy genre.
And that the main characters in those books also tend to be women.
Yes.
Often werewolf women, but not always.
Yeah. Yeah, Anita Blake in those books is I think later she becomes aware something, but she's human, although she ends up being the head of the pack and possibly the queen vampire and God only knows what else along the way. But she has an assortment of supernatural lovers along the way as well. It's also worth mentioning Twilight.
Is it worth mentioning?
It's a bit of an elephant in the room if we don't mention it.
I think we should talk about Twilight.
I think perhaps more under films, because I've only read the first book. As far as I know, neither of you have read the first book, whereas we've seen a few of the films.
Yes.
And there's not really very much werewolf stuff in the first book. Jacob, the kind of primary werewolf from the love triangle point of view, is present in the first book, but there's not very much of him. We get much more werewolfy stuff in the films of the later books.
But as you said, the werewolves are basically just there to be not vampires.
Yes. Yes, indeed. We were talking about this earlier and I was quoting Baldrick's definition of a cat, not a dog, which is the main purpose of werewolves in that story. We have to have something as an opposite to vampires in order to properly construct our love triangle, and werewolves it is. They're not very interesting from a wolf point of view.
So that was books. Now, as you said, Liz, we're broadening the scope out to talk about other media. So there's film and there's TV. So what I'd like to talk about is the appearance of the werewolf on film. And I think it is distinct from television as well.
I think so too.
What I'm thinking about, when I think about werewolves in film, I first go back to what I consider the sort of, it's almost the golden age of werewolves appearing on screen as the single horrific transforming monster, which I would say that's sometime around the 80s when you had, obviously you've had werewolf fiction before then, but you have an era where, thanks to the likes of Wes Craven and other horror directors in the early 80s, you have a great focus on physical effects. So, for example, the transformation in American Werewolf in London is a long, detailed and almost agonizing scene to watch. It's really fascinating and it is an impressive piece of cinematography. And you have similar transformations in other films. The Howling, which I haven't actually seen, although I have seen the transformations a bit. Apparently, The Howling suffered from coming out only a few months before American Werewolf in London, and suffers by comparison. And it's based on a set of novels, which it deviates from, but it's also its own film franchise, and I've not watched any of it. There's of course Teen Wolf, and Michael J. Fox goes through his wolfy transformation in the bathroom, just sort of worrying what's happening to him. And then you've got things like Fright Night, which is, yes, that's a vampire movie, but there is a bit of werewolf. There is a wolf-like vampire in that one, which is, it's got the classic that the wolf is slain and it reverts to a human form. And then going back to what you said, Becky, earlier about Angela Carter, we have, of course, the A Company of Wolves, which is just a magnificent film. And I have deep affection for that film, my childhood. That also has some remarkable physical effects in it, and a very vivid transformation scene where you basically have the wolf fighting its way out of the human, which is a common thing that you have in all of this physical transformation stuff. Now, the thing about you mentioned about Twilight late, and of course there are other things, sort of more modern films like Underworld, is you go from having physical effects to CGI. And whereas the physical transformation looks painful and drawn out, and there's a real visceral quality to it, the transformation in Twilight is just like flicking a switch. And it's just they go from being a beautiful human to a beautiful wolf. Mm-hmm. There's no pain. There's no. It's basically they're just like vampires sparkle. The werewolves just transform into beautiful animals. They don't go through this horrible and quite messy intermediate stage of shape shifting, which is, you know, I think it would turn anybody off. So there is that. And then, of course, Underworld, similarly, it's the Kate Beckinsale vehicle. It's the wolves are sort of, they're more grotesque, but certainly being CGI, they're still it's funny, all of the lichen human forms look very much like the lichen wolf form, in that they've chosen big and muscly actors to play them, with the exception of Martin Sheen, who is like the hardest lichen there, so that's the other one. And then, of course, we have to mention the indies, which include Ginger Snaps and the Ginger Snaps trilogy, which we just recently watched Ginger Snaps back. And that is sort of totally werewolf as antagonist and of an alien invading force. And it is all about surviving against the werewolves. There is no real sympathetic protagonist. All you have is this disease that overtakes Ginger and transforms her. And of course, she is a sympathetic character, and she at least has some of humanity left in some of the films. But it's clear that, just like in most of this kind of fiction where you have werewolves as this monstrous being that's totally uncontrollable, it really is something that, it effectively devours one's soul and turns one into a killer with almost zero redemption. And I think this is pretty common throughout a lot of werewolf appearances on the cinema. It's a thing to be horrified by and feared, as opposed to a sympathetic creature, which is a clan of transforming beautiful humans who, you know, roam out in the wilds and howl at the moon and shag each other.
Okay.
Have you got any other comments about films before we go on to TV?
I just wanted to make an honourable mention for Dog Soldiers.
Oh, good one, yes.
Which is a kind of probably pretty ancient now. I think it was a British movie, wasn't it? About a group of soldiers who are out on manoeuvres. I think they're out on training manoeuvres. They're definitely British because Sean Pertwee is one of the main characters, and one by one the soldiers get taken out by werewolves. And I just remember some of the themes of Dog Soldiers in the way that the place that they are going out on manoeuvres, it's the isolation of it and of the isolation of the place, and the way that, you know, these are soldiers and the way that they kind of react as if they're in a kind of a warlike situation. I just think that it's a really well put together, really horrible, lovely, werewolf movie. And I think that it's not quite the big, it because it's kind of quite British in its appeal and its outlook. And it's that kind of, I think that I have this possibly incorrect view. So, you know, people can challenge me on that, and that's cool. That you have Hollywood movies which are big on special effects, and they're kind of very kind of large scale dramas. And then I've noticed that there's a tendency in British fiction, and this is across a number of different genres, that it tends to be quite small scale, quite isolated, and just gritty and a bit kind of horrible in a kind of a low level sandpaper grating against your skin way. And that's how I feel about Dog Soldiers. It's definitely worth a look.
Yeah, Dog Soldiers is a great call, and it does call back again to it fits the template of the werewolf as an antagonist, an unstoppable force, and something to be horrified by, and the transformations that happen when they're forced upon characters who are bitten are horrifying, and you know, they're pretty much an irreversible change that is not going to be redeemable in any way.
Yeah.
But that's a great call, and I really like Sean Pertwee in that. Well, I like all the actors. I think they're fantastic.
But he likes Sean Pertwee in everything.
Do you? Well, good choice.
I do like Sean Pertwee in everything.
Let's talk about television and Let's talk about your examples, Liz.
First of all, I'd like to air a theory. So I've got a theory that the way werewolves are portrayed differs quite dramatically, quite consistently between the three media we're talking about. And you've both talked a bit about how werewolves are typically portrayed in film and in books, where in film they're often the antagonist, the malevolent force that needs to be dealt with some way. In books, they're typically the sexy, romantic kind of werewolf. So my theory is that in TV, they're sort of halfway between those, and much more like humans. And the particular TV shows I want to talk about, Teen Wolf is my main one, the current Teen Wolf TV show, which is dramatically different from the 80s film, and therefore oughtn't really even to have the same name. But we've also got Buffy and Grimm and Lost Girl and True Blood, all being fairly recent shows of kind of broadly... No, Buffy isn't recent anymore, but they're all broadly similar in that the werewolves are part of an ensemble cast who are, in at least some of those cases, partly involved with solving crimes or mysteries of some sort, typically in a group that also involves humans and other supernaturals. And there are also werewolves on the other side. So we've got this group of people who are investigating crimes and mysteries and dodgy goings-on of various sorts. And sometimes those dodgy goings-on are the fault of some other werewolves. And sometimes the werewolf in our little in-group is a useful conduit to those. That's what happens in Grimm. So the character of Monroe, who is, in Grimm terms, a bloopbot. Something like that.
I think.
some German-inspired word that I cannot pronounce, but he's basically a werewolf. He is the tame werewolf of our police detectives who are investigating things and acts as their gateway into the world of the supernatural creatures and can perform introductions and get them useful contacts. Other times, as with Teen Wolf, we have the majority of the main group are werewolves, although they've got other supers and also humans on side. And then much of the plot comes from their interaction with other werewolf packs, who are sometimes the bad guys, sometimes residents, sometimes visitors. But the thing is that the werewolves operate on both sides. They're just like humans. They have different powers and different kinds of issues that they're wrestling with, but they're not intrinsically good or intrinsically bad, or indeed intrinsically sexy, although quite a lot of them are sexy, of course, because TV.
I've got a comment that I'd like to make, which is a lot of the TV stuff with you know, werewolves as part of an ensemble cast or part of a sort of greater supernatural conspiracy is that they end up being a sort of a club of, that they are the supernatural club. That's what the pack does.
Yeah.
And you can see that, you know, Teen Wolf's an example where you bring new cast members into the club by having them be bitten and transformed into werewolves.
Yeah, and Teen Wolf's also interesting because two of my favourite characters in Teen Wolf were believed to be human in earlier seasons, and I thought that was a really interesting dynamic that the human characters were there kind of as a foil for the wolves, but they were the most interesting characters. And then in the most recent series that we watched, those two interesting human characters turned out to either never have been or not anymore human, although they weren't wolves. So they've introduced new kinds of supernatural stuff as kind of a contrast to the wolves. But Teen Wolf has a quite well-developed pack structure politics thing with alphas and much like the kinds of thing that we get in, for example, Kelly Armstrong, where we have different positions within the pack and different ways that the pack relates to the world around them.
one of the points I want to make about Hemlock Grove is it doesn't really fit that model.
Yeah.
Which might be one of the reasons why it's not actually as interesting and it doesn't fit an episodic TV series. It does have a good werewolf transformation in it, though, which is the character once again sheds their human skin to the point that the wolf that comes out of them eats the remnants of the human.
Oh, I like that.
Bit of a spoiler, but like I said, don't bother watching it, and I'll tell you. One of the things that tracks the authorities back to this protagonist as a wolf is they find one of his hairs in a stool sample. Which is nice. Not really. Anyway, it had a lot of promise, actually, with the... initially, you have a werewolf attack, which you don't see. You just you just see the destruction that it wreaks around the place and the person that it kills. And that could have been really promising as the sort of the big bad enemy. Well,
Netflix have revisited that basic setup with Riverdale, only without werewolves, and much more successfully, I think.
That's true. I think Riverdale's just basically better written, though. It's not that not.
Yeah, I mean, you can easily add werewolves into Riverdale, and that would be fine. A Riverdale Teen Wolf crossover, for example, could be very productive. Mm.
The problem with Hemlock Grove, and it's not really a werewolf issue, is that there is a lot of weird subplots and strange stuff going on that doesn't really fit together. And individually, it might be kind of cool, but it's not got a lot of charisma. So I think that's why it falls flat. But that's unfortunate. There's not a lot of plot to actually enjoy. It's just one thing happens, and also it doesn't really join up very effectively.
Talking of lack of charisma, we should make a dishonourable mention for the Bitten TV show.
Yes, I watched one episode, and God, that was awful.
I managed about six, I think.
Well, I've seen both. I've seen seasons one and two, and I probably watch season three.
Does it get better then?
Oh no. No, but not everything I read and watch is quality, you know. It's not a patch on the books. I think that it does some interesting things that other werewolf TV doesn't do, in that instead of it being a happy Scooby gang with a token wolf, or instead of it being a sort of the werewolf being a sort of a mindless feral creature, which is just completely out of control. There are some interesting bits where the pack members, who, you know, to all intents and purposes, are the protagonists and the people that we're empathising with in the show, do quite a lot of very either morally grey or outright awful things to protect the pack as humans, taking not necessarily human decisions, but they're doing some awful things which you might normally associate with the out of control wolf, but they're taking it in their human forms with their human reasoning faculties. The main character, Elena, who is the kind of the character that, you know, through her eyes we're seeing what's going on. It's not the same Elena from the books, but it's another blonde woman called Elena. But, you know, she does kill quite a lot of people in some quite brutal ways. You know, she commits murder to protect her pack, and she doesn't do it while she's in wolf form, completely out of control. She does it quite deliberately.
That reminds me of a role-playing game I played quite recently.
Oh, really?
I guess we'll come back to that.
But I want to make another honourable mention, if I can, for Being Human.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. I've thought about that.
Which is another, I know that there is an American version of it, but my heart is with the British version, which absolutely typifies what you were saying earlier on, Liz. It's three flatmates, a vampire, a ghost and a werewolf,
yep,
living in a flat share together, And there are some horrible things that happen in it, and then there are some very heartwarming, very funny things that happen in it. And it is a lovely British take on the kind of the Scooby gang dynamic, I think.
Yeah, I did see a little bit of it, but really not very much. Not quite sure how it passed me by, because I enjoyed what I saw.
It's really well put together, really well done. And three great actors in the main roles as well.
Going back to Bitten, I just want to sort of clarify something. So it sounds a lot like the way you phrased it is these are a bunch of basically an amoral, at least from a human perspective, master race, or a supernatural conspiracy of werewolves. Is that right?
I think there is a supernatural conspiracy of werewolves, as there is in a lot of these novels, that there is, it's a little bit the flip side of what Josh and I like to call the what the fuck genre, which is, if you imagine something like Neverwhere, you think that the world is one thing, and then the protagonist finds out it's something else. Well, these urban fantasy novels, you're already living in the something else world, that there is a supernatural skin underneath the world that the majority of people don't see. So there's absolutely a kind of a supernatural conspiracy from that angle. And yeah, I definitely think there's a master race element in that there are some characters in the show and in the books who kind of give voice to the idea that werewolves are naturally superior and therefore they should be in charge.
Going back to the pack thing, it's makes me think of something the way I always thought about the difference between Vampire the Masquerade first edition and second edition. So the first edition is all about being an outsider to humanity, and the second edition is all about being an insider to a supernatural conspiracy. It sounds a lot about this sort of belonging to a pack and belonging to this conspiracy is sort of one version of this sort of club of super friends, or whatever you're going to call them, versus the outsider, which is a werewolf or a vampire or something else that has to do terrible things to survive on its own. So,
yeah, because we're all players of the 90s, we basically call it the Masquerade if left to ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. Are we ready to start to unpick all of this for some themes?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Becky, why don't you start us off, given that you've probably read the most widely into this?
Well, I don't know about that, but I'm very happy to start us off. I think that traditionally, werewolves are seen as a metaphor for sex in a way that, in the flip side of the way that vampires are seen as a metaphor for sex. So one of the things that goes on with vampires in a lot of vampire literature, and certainly comes up in some of the Vampire the Masquerade role-playing materials, is the idea that it's a sort of a... the vampire's embrace is a metaphor for sex. I think on the werewolf side of things, it's this theme of humanity versus animal instinct. And whether that is done by you're a human and you're aware of these overpowering drives that are coming from this werewolf inside you, or whether this is when you change into a werewolf, your human side is either just a passenger or is completely oblivious to what your werewolf is doing and you have no memory of it and they just act like an animal. But yeah, the ideas around sex and virginity tied up with the werewolf myth are really, really strong ones, and they are brought out probably most blatantly and obviously in Angela Carter's The Werewolf, which is in The Bloody Chamber. There's obviously ideas about metamorphosis, about something within yourself which is alien to you, which is taking you over, as we've already talked about. I think that I was really pleased that you talked about Ginger Snaps, because I think Ginger Snaps is probably my favourite werewolf film. Probably, yeah, definitely. What I always remember about the very first Ginger Snaps film is in Ginger Snaps, the wolf and the metamorphosis into the wolf is being used as a coda for puberty because of the age that Ginger is. And there's a really, really interesting, horrible, but interesting scene where the vestigial tail that we all have as humans, your coccyx, in her, it starts to grow. And it starts to get longer and longer. So it's not that she goes through a transformation, suddenly she's a wolf. It's that little bits of her start to change in the way that puberty would affect your body. And I remember there is a scene where she just tries to cut the tail off with a carving knife, and then it grows back. And it's just this kind of horrible, her body is completely out of her control, and she is mutilating herself to try and get it back under her control, and it's not working. I think that that kind of, the themes there about puberty, about there being an alien taking over your body, are just kind of, just in that one scene, it just brings it all out in this really visceral way. But I think that the other theme that, again, I think Angela Carter and others also deal with is the power, masculinity, dominance and power plays. I know that these days there's a lot of articles about how our conception of werewolves is wrong, because it's based on the idea of a werewolf pack, of a normal wolf pack, and wolf packs don't actually have alphas and dominance and games if they're in the wild and they're left to their own devices. But actually, for me, the idea that there would be alphas and dominance games in a werewolf pack is absolutely right and correct, not coming from the wolf side, but coming from the human side. And that's what I think is most interesting about werewolves, is that I think the deeper you look into how it's treated, the more things you start to unpick about the human condition rather than the wolf condition, if you know what I mean. Anyway, anyone else?
Yes.
No, I don't have anything to add to that. Those would have been the things that I had said.
Cool.
Do you?
Well, I do actually, and mine is, I'm coming from a completely different perspective, which is more to do with the mythic role of the werewolf as something which is possibly human but changes under cover of night into something that's alien and very dangerous. So I'm thinking about the let's forget the modern urban setting, we'll go back to a village setting centuries earlier, where you have first of all the concept that people change shape and therefore become other and become something wild and very dangerous. And of course, that goes back to werewolf myths from probably, I believe, the 11th century onwards. We're talking about, for example, raiders who will wear wolf skins or other kinds of costume that make them appear frightening and supernatural. And then there's the general idea of adopting a mask to frighten someone else and to put some distance between yourself and your humanity. And of course, you could do that as a war tactic. You could also do it sort of adopting a mask as a means of contacting a higher state of spirituality. So there are those things about adopting a sort of a persona or a mask that projects you into a different kind of mental state or a different kind of social state. And the idea that this the werewolf lurks on the fringes of civilization is kind of interesting. I'd like to talk about this when we talk about the role-playing section, because it's one of my favourite things is, for example, Beyond the Wall, which is all about this village community and going outside it into danger. And one of the a really good example of that kind of thing is actually M. Night Shyamalan's The Village, which is all about the idea that the colour red is forbidden, and that's because those who live in the woods wear the colour red, etc. And you see this sort of monstrous things which...
I'm laughing because the game that Becky and I are playing in at the moment, one of the rules of the community is that the colour red is forbidden.
Is that
we haven't
right?
really unpicked why or how yet. I can't remember who came up with it, but evidently they've seen that film.
I see. It's an incredibly atmospheric film for at least the first half, and it's very effective.
Mm.
But it's that kind of thing where you say there is something monstrous outside, and if you step into its territory, then it will devour you. And the idea that people could be ostracized from their community because they have been infected by this monstrous trait, and they will change against their will in many cases, or be forced to live outside the community because they are something monstrous. That, I think, is particularly interesting. And, of course, there's heavy overlap between this and vampire mythology of the there's something in the blood and it forces you to alien hungers, etc. And it's a different take on it, but it is very closely related, obviously.
Well, I think there's some interesting differences in the dividing line about how civilized they are. So vampires are the civilized and in some cases urbanized side, whereas werewolves are the uncivilized wilderness, more natural world rather than constructed world sort of side.
That is true. The werewolf is like, it is lurking just outside civilization.
Yeah. Werewolves live in the woods.
And vampires
are close to the earth and care about the environment. And
and the vampire is the monster that is hiding with a mask of a human.
Yeah.
So
in a castle or a city or a tower block or...
Oh. Whatever we care for, that, and they are still monstrous, and they actually have that. They will also transform. So the next logical step is, let's talk about how the role playing games do it. I have one role playing game, which is a very obvious role playing game. I could mention Werewolf the Apocalypse. Now my copy is the first edition, the one with all of the incredibly bad editing job that they rushed out for Gen Con, I believe, and has the all these C-page XXs in it. And it's very interesting because, unlike Vampire, it doesn't have a bibliography. I don't know if this is something they fixed in the second edition, which I presume had much better production values. The interesting thing about Werewolf the Apocalypse, and for this I'm going to refer to another podcast, which is the System Mastery podcast, which just had their most recent episode is concerning Werewolf the Apocalypse, and they made this very astute point, is that whereas something like Vampire is playing on archetypes of vampires, Werewolf the Apocalypse basically disappears up its own backside with its own mythology. It creates lots of weird and arcane terms for its myth, like the Weaver, the Wild, and the Worm, and Cairns, and the Umbra, and Moots, and all sorts of other language, which a lot of it makes sense in terms of the, in terms of what they're talking about, this pack behavior and this tribal mentality, and also the greater spiritual myth. But it is its own thing. There isn't actually any direct line from those werewolves to the werewolf myths, apart from the fact that werewolves are big and scary, which is not the same as vampires, where you have the misshapen Nosferatu and the vampire punk Bruand and the aloof Ventru and the decadent Toreador, etc., etc. So that, I think, is kind of interesting, in that it calls itself a werewolf game. You could repurpose that as any kind of, you know, supernatural conspiracy game that just happens to be fighting against Pentex Corporation, and that's about it.
Yeah.
So that's the obvious werewolf role playing game. What other?
I think there's another obvious one.
Well, there is one. We're going to come to that in a moment.
No, not that one.
Right, which one?
Werewolf the Party Game.
Okay, good.
Which I actually only just thought of while we were talking earlier. The one where there's a big group of you and you have roles randomly assigned. Well, if you're a werewolf, the rest of you are villagers. And then at night, everyone closes their eyes and the werewolf taps somebody on the shoulder and that person is now a werewolf.
Yes.
It's a role-playing game. It's about werewolves.
And it's been around for a really long time. I remember playing that at university.
Yeah, in the 11th century.
Yeah, pretty much. Certainly feels that way now.
It's quite that old.
How old is Werewolf the Party Game?
I don't know. I mean, I know that you can now buy it. I'm not sure what you get for your money, considering it seems to me to be kind of the quintessential game that you can play with no props whatsoever.
I played it long before it was in print.
Yes, dear. I'm sure you did.
So, and I think a lot of people did.
Yeah, I did, yeah. There's something kind of nice about the idea of games which are purely oral tradition. And I feel a little bit sad if a game which had an unbroken line of oral tradition has now been put into print.
I think probably the oral tradition continues. If nothing else, I've just explained the brief rules of how to play to anyone listening to this podcast who hadn't previously heard of it. It's a bit more glorified than that, but not very much. I think that's the other obvious werewolf game.
Yeah, there's not a great deal. So now, Werewolf the Apocalypse, I think, is a great big mess. and could certainly do with a bit of editing and paring down, Becky.
There's also Monster Hearts.
There is.
And Urban Shadows also both have a werewolf class of character in it, but it's not. They're not games about being werewolves per se.
I'm sure there's werewolves in the Dresden Files, and there's werewolves in the what is it called? Ghosts of Albion.
And in Buffy, I expect.
I was going to mention two other games, or sort of four other games, depending on how you look at it. So I don't know how many people are familiar with Emily Kerbos's romance trilogy. Breaking the Ice, Shooting the Moon, and Under My Skin. But all three of those, I think it's Emily who has devised werewolf reskinnings for all three of those games.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Which I think is really, really interesting because I think they're still romance style games, but they deal more with, some of the complications of being a werewolf or being in a werewolf pack, which I think is very interesting. And also there's a very, very small, probably not very well-known game by Caitlin Bell, which the name completely escapes me, but it's something about dumping my werewolf boyfriend.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that.
That sounds familiar.
Which is a very small sort of game poem type thing for a solo player. But there's also that.
Well, while we're on the subject of role-playing games that could feature werewolves, which is kind of that starts to become a very broad offering. I think I'd like to mention two things. One is the way that lycanthropy is treated in games like Dungeons and Dragons and RuneQuest, in that it is a communicable disease that, at least it certainly, I'm pretty sure it is in RuneQuest, and if you get it and you eventually succumb to it, you stop playing your character because you become a monster.
That would be the film approach then.
Well, yes, pretty much. But it's kind of you. This it's kind of you're saying that this is a disease and you are no longer playable. Now, of course, I think there might be an interesting transitional bit where you acquire power and expend humanity as a result of it. So there is an interesting thing you could look at, but if you're looking for how the role-playing game, how the fantasy games deal with it, that's pretty much it. It's game over as a player, and it's something you never want to get, ditto becoming a vampire in those kinds of games. The other one I wanted to mention is Chill. Chill is by, I've got the Mayfair Games 2nd edition on my shelf. The thing about Chill, which is basically a supernatural investigation game that is a pretty much the first edition was around the same time as first edition Call of Cthulhu, possibly a little bit later. But what they did in the second edition is they had these fantastic individual splat books for monsters, and I've got one for ghosts, and there's one for vampires, and there's one for werewolves, and there's one also the companion deals with fitting certain styles of horror to your game. But Chill is kind of interesting in that you could run an entire campaign fighting one particular kind of antagonist. So the one that's basically around apparitions is all about being ghost hunters, and it's just a monster manual for ghosts, all of whom have interesting ways they manifest, ways they may be defeated, and sort of would prompt certain lines of investigation. I haven't read the werewolf one, but I'd be interested to see if it's as well written as the apparitions one, because that's again, it goes back to werewolves are possibly irredeemable monsters. I don't know how they've treated it, because of course there's skinwalkers and there's the mindless werewolves, and there might be much more benign characters in those, but it would be interesting to read those. Anything more?
I think the only thing that kind of leapt into my mind when you said skinwalkers is that we haven't even really touched on shapeshifting in role-playing games and the analogies between shapeshifting and lycanthropy and how they diverge and how they come together. Because whilst you're right, in a lot of sort of fantasy themed games, lycanthropy is this communicable disease. For example, druids and others can shapeshift into all sorts of other animal forms. And so it's really, it's kind of the degrees of control that you have. And where that is interesting is that the kind of new wave of modern werewolf fiction is people who are very much in control of their... They weren't in control of getting the werewolf curse in the first place, but they're very much in control of when they change, what they do about it, how their mind works when they're in that body.
So they can essentially shag in Krenos form, right?
Yeah.
That's basically it. They just want to be able to get their end away whilst they're a werewolf.
Yeah, sexy probably. Werewolves. Sexy werewolves are sexy.
Werewolves. So we're talking about role playing games, and Becky, we've asked you onto the show specifically also to talk about your game, which is Bite Me, and I think you ran yet another playtest of it recently.
I feel like I spent all year playtesting this game. Which is hopefully is a good thing, and hopefully it's going to be going out for external playtesting early next year, depending on whether I can survive between now and the end of the year without getting another chest infection. But yes, I talked about Bite Me on our Bitten podcast because it's very heavily influenced by Kelly Armstrong and also by that kind of genre of the modern new wave of sexy romantic werewolves who are much more in control of their lycanthropy.
So we're talking about, this is essentially about a werewolf pack, right?
Yeah, it is, because I feel that there aren't really games out there, and I'm going to include Werewolf in the Apocalypse in this, there aren't really games out there which have mechanised what it's like to be in a werewolf pack. And I'll explain what I mean by this, and I'm going to reference Jerry Springer. And if anybody's following me on G+, they might have seen a comment that I've written recently in relation to Jerry Springer and how I feel it relates to the Amber game. But it is relevant here, and I'll explain what I mean. So, I have watched some Jerry Springer or Jeremy Kyle for people who are in the UK. And one of the things that I have actually been quite fascinated by in these shows is that you have people who come on these shows who are in these horrendous relationships, and they're both just tearing each other apart. And at some point, Jeremy Kyle or Jerry Springer will sort of smugly say, "Well, why don't you just leave?" And nobody's ever got a good answer. You know, there is some sort of invisible tie which just keeps these people coming back and kind of scratching away at each other when, you know, there really is nothing just stopping them getting up and going somewhere else and living a different life and probably a happier one. And whilst I don't necessarily think that that's what everybody inside a werewolf pack is doing to each other, I'm very interested in the idea of these kind of absolutely unbreakable, invisible psychological bonds between people. And I don't think that there is a better kind of exemplar of that in fiction other than the werewolf pack. Particularly in the new wave of fiction and the way the kind of the pack is tied together. And it goes back to what you were saying a bit earlier on, Ralph, about, you know, if you were in a village bordered by a terrifying wood... and you were cast out for being a werewolf, and you were out on your own in the wood, that's a pretty terrible position to be being to be in. Likewise, a lot of the books, like Kelly Armstrong and others, the idea of being outside the pack, it's like being thrown out on your own into the woods. There is something within every werewolf that desires to be in a family, in a pack. And I really wanted to create a game which has some mechanics around how those kind of invisible ties would work.
Cool. So your game, which is called Bite Me, yes?
Yes.
And if I'm not mistaken, it's a Powered by the Apocalypse style game.
It is. It is a Powered by the Apocalypse style game.
So would you like to run down through a couple of the playbooks that to give a flavour of sort of the people who interact, because obviously it can be quite PvP, and so there's going to be certain styles of play there.
Absolutely, and it should be quite PvP, but PvP in a very, well, it's Powered by the Apocalypse, isn't it? So it's PvP in a very specific way. So one of the playbooks is called The Enforcer, and they does what it says on the tin. They are not in charge of the pack. They are a big bad wolf who goes around making sure the pack is kept safe, and this plays into, I think, ideas around people who do terrible things so that people they love don't have to do those things and bear those burdens. So how you choose to interpret the enforcer character is up to you. But in my mind, a lot of it is... Okay, I'm going to come back to Buffy now.
I knew it.
There's a particular scene in Buffy which is really important to me. And I know you know this, Liz. But... it was very impressionable when I was a young teenager watching the scene in, I think, series 4. It's the Glory series, when Glory is a very, very powerful goddess who is destroying everything, but sometimes they turn into a human who is just a human. And there is a point at which Glory needs to be defeated. Glory has turned into a human. It would be really, really easy to just kill the human, and Giles does it. So that Buffy doesn't have to, so that Buffy can stay being that kind of black and white hero, that she doesn't have to go into the shades of grey. He does it to save her from that. And the Enforcer is sort of built along those lines of what guilt burdens are you carrying for the pack so that they don't have to. So that's one of the characters. And then on the flip side of that, there's a character called the Cub. And the character of the Cub is somebody who's a pretty newly turned werewolf. They're pretty naive about the whole thing. They might be engaging in some hero worship. They're looking for people to show them how to be a werewolf. So they're quite flexible in what they can and can't do. They can break some rules with an element of impunity because everybody indulges the kid who isn't really grown up yet, who hasn't come into a responsibility. Come into their responsibility yet. But there's also the idea that, you know, being the child, the ever child of the pack might start to chafe after a while, and how you deal with growing up and, you know, and your changing relationship with the pack as you become more of the person you're going to be.
Excellent. My next question is, given that it's Powered by the Apocalypse and I'm sure that there could be quite a bit of conflict in there, is there external conflict? Are there missions or arcs or external threats, or are you expecting a lot of the action to be?
I'm hoping it will, and this is the way I'm directing the MC guidance, is that it's going to be 50-50. What I expect a campaign or a session of Bite Me to look like is this dance between forcing the players to work together to protect the pack from external threats, and then watching the pack tear each other apart when they are not being so threatened, and then a kind of undulating between those two states. So you're constantly doing a dance as the MC between introducing external threats, which threaten the pack enough that they have to put aside their differences and work together. And that is really, as I go back to that Jerry Springer example, that is forcing them to recognise those emotional ties that they can't get rid of, that ultimately, when the worst happens, you will stand and fight for your pack no matter how you're currently feeling about them. But also driving down hard some in pretty big tensions to try and crack the pack as much as you can in between those scenes. So yeah, it's a very much a balancing act between those two states.
Excellent. And I think one other thing I'd like to ask is that we've talked about the kinds of werewolves there are in this kind of fiction. So what kind of werewolves are these? Do they have painful transformations, or are they totally in control?
I think that's not an either-or state. I think that... in order to enjoy some pathos and some really hardcore angsting, the process of changing your form can always be very, very painful. However, you can still have complete control. And I think as characters in a role-playing game, when you're playing werewolves full-time in a pack, it's just more interesting to say that you can direct your characters most of the time. Most of the time. That said, there will be mechanisms in the game which are very heavily red flagged up at the beginning, because I know that mind control is a really hot topic in role-playing games.
Yeah.
Absolutely understandably so. There are various different safety mechanisms around how dominance and similar will work in Bite Me, but they are in Bite Me. Because part of what this game is about is playing with the idea that sometimes someone will order you to do something you really don't want to do, but there is an invisible string within you, which means you just can't say no, because wanting to obey is more, it overrides you more than your desire not to do the thing.
Good.
And that's part of where the tension, where you're trying to crack the, as MC, where you're trying to pull that pack apart, comes in. People are asking you to do things you really don't want to do. You do them anyway. You can go through periods of self-loathing. You can go through periods of loathing that person. And then as MC, your job is to make sure that no matter how divisive you are being with the pack, is you're then giving them a reason to come back together and work together, even if they're doing that while they hate each other.
And it's worth noting, I was in one of your playtests of this game. I think it's worth emphasising the way that you've built all of that movement between those two states into the mechanics, whereby in the scenes where the pack are tearing each other apart, the players are rewarded with shinies for pushing each other's buttons in an assortment of ways. So in order to build up points to spend in the external plot focus scenes, which are otherwise really, really brutal and serious risk of bad things happening, you have to spend some time in between arguing and really pulling each other's emotional strings, because doing that makes the eventual fights and confrontations go a little bit more in your favour.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And then there's also the use of questions, as there is in a lot of Apocalypse, powered by the Apocalypse games, a lot of questions in the setup, so that you are starting the game with difficult relationships already in play. For example, the cub, the playbook that I talked about earlier, in the setup phase of that, you're going to be answering the question, who in the pack is it that I hero worship, and what could they do to shatter my trust forever? Which is obviously designed to give the MC a huge lever with a big flag on it that says pull me.
Well, that sounds great. So thanks for that, Becky. I'm moving on from that. That's obviously your take on the werewolf and what you want to do with werewolves in a role-playing game. I wanted to ask Liz, do you have a preference for do you have any ideas about how you'd run a role-playing game and what of those things you'd make use of?
So for me, the things that make werewolves interesting are the moving backwards and forwards across the boundaries. And Bite Me is dealing with one of those boundaries between internal conflict and external conflict, effectively. One of the boundaries that comes up time and again in the TV shows I was talking about earlier is the one between, well, it's back to the Masquerade as well, between the people who know what's going on and the people who don't. So my big idea for a werewolf-inspired game, although it actually takes in various other supernatural creatures, is to play the police officers in a small town with various kinds of supernatural creatures causing various kinds of havoc. The police officers themselves are in the know. Some of them are probably supernatural creatures themselves, and I'm using police officers broadly, so not necessarily actual police officers, but a group of investigative characters, as we see in, for example, Buffy. And the boundary that I'm interested in exploring there is alternating scenes where, on the one hand, you're investigating some sort of supernatural threat in all of the usual ways, and in the next scene, you're working out how to present this to the top brass or the people who are in charge of your organisation, or perhaps in the big city, which doesn't have these problems. And these people do not know about the supernatural threat. So you're writing slightly fabricated reports, you're having meetings with people, you're being told about the quotas that you need to follow and the procedures you need to follow, and you're working out how to flex all of that stuff to fit in with what you actually know about werewolves and other supernaturals, but without actually telling your boss that there are werewolves, because obviously your boss would then think you were mad. So that's my game idea.
I think that sounds that has a lot of legs as a short campaign if you can apply the right pressure.
I'd love to play that. That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. I think I might run that one, actually. That's one of my favourite ideas I've had for ages.
I've got one last thing I'd like to say about my preferences for werewolves in role-playing games. And I said that I wanted to talk about Vampire the Masquerade and White Wolf in general. So Werewolf the Apocalypse, as previously mentioned on both this podcast and others, doesn't really feel like it's about a specific werewolf myth. It feels like it's own thing. And I guess if you're deep into that, that's great. I'm not. And I think you need to invest fully in it. And it's also, I think, that in a lot of cases, the perspective of that myth is incompatible with the other bits of White Wolf stuff. I've got an interesting quote from the back of the Werewolf First Edition that I've got in my hand. It says, "Storyteller series. Werewolf is but one part of the storyteller tetralogy." Really? "A series of five storytelling games set in the Gothic punk milieu." Tetralogy? I thought that's four.
Yes, it is.
Well, you can see, this is, as previously mentioned, this was not really proofread before it went out in print. Okay, now, it says, "Vampire is already available, along with a number of supplements and source books, but the remaining three games in the series will be released once a year. Following Werewolf will come Mage, then Fairy, and finally Ghost. All five games use the same game system, but are unique and designed to be played individually." Which is so obviously not what the buying public wanted when they ended up implementing these, that they, you know, that people would mix and match these role-playing games freely and indeed play all manner of weird things when it came to live action, which is kind of interesting. Why am I mentioning that? Because going back to Vampire First Edition, before any of this other nonsense came out, Vampire was very nicely self-contained within its own thing. It was, you were playing vampires and you had a particular style of campaign you would play, which was, of course, the urban fantasy in this nightmarish nighttime existence. Now, what's the role of the werewolves in that situation? They're basically to scare the shit out of vampires. The whole reason that vampires live in urban centres is because it's actually really hard for them to move between cities. And the idea is that out between the cities are the lupines, who are just, if you take the mechanics of First Edition Vampire, it said, well, you know, just double every physical stat they have to start with and then give them a whole load of extra powers on top. Mm. And that's how tough a werewolf is. And you read that and you say, well, it's obvious that a vampire would never survive an encounter with a werewolf. And the idea is that they can also smell the taint of vampirism. And so as soon as a vampire starts to move between from one city to another, it becomes a phenomenally dangerous thing for them to do, because there's the idea that there are these werewolves living out between them and they will seek out vampires and murder them any way they can. Driving between cities, I guess, makes things easier, but I had one scene in one game where I just had, basically, vampires were forced to move between cities and this werewolf ran onto a motorway and pushed their car running at 70 miles an hour off the motorway and then proceeded to slaughter everything inside. And that, to me, is what a werewolf should be. If you want it to scare things, it should be horrific and frightening and also slightly unknowable. And the problem I have with Werewolf the Apocalypse is suddenly they were no longer lupines. They were all garu. And so once they start being referred to by this artsy-fartsy New Age language, instead of the sort of lupine, which sounds derogatory, but also with an air of mysticism and certainly monstrosity as well, you call them guru instead, and they, well, you know that they're dangerous creatures because you've read the Werewolf the Apocalypse role-playing game, but actually they don't seem nearly as frightening as if they were just these unknowable, unstoppable forces that just dwelt in the spaces where vampires don't exist. And that, I think, is part of the interesting thing about werewolves. And when I introduced werewolves into my Department V game, they were effectively, nobody knew they were werewolves. What they were things that people couldn't even look at because of the aura they cast around everyone was, drove people insane or forced them not to actually recognize their existence. Because of course, if they did see them, then they would be consumed by supernatural fear. So that's what I think werewolves should be. They're a monster to me, and they are massively underused. And, you know, I think they're sort of horrible transforming thing. The myth around them should also be as this mask that people adopt as something to frighten another group of people. And you should try your very best to frighten people with them. That's my point of view.
Cool. Awesome.
I think we're nearing the end of the podcast. So I'd like to sort of say, are there any final thoughts you'd like to pass around? Any other books that or films that we haven't mentioned, or other ideas you've got? I'm going to go first of all with Becky.
I think I've covered all the big ones. I think if I have an end thought, it's that I would like to see the mythology of werewolves in the modern era kind of up there with vampires. And I think it's getting there, but I feel like we've been absolutely saturated with vampire mythology for a really long time. And I think it is time for the Lycans to have their day and become ascendant now.
Wow, jolly good. Let's go Team Lycan.
Well, I get the impression that Teen Wolf is pretty big, so maybe we're on our way there.
Excellent.
You still haven't watched it, have you?
I've watched a bit of it, but then I got sidetracked by something else that I needed to watch instead.
Fair enough.
Derek and Stiles.
Yes, it's true. I need to get back to it. I have seen some of it.
Derek and Stiles.
I've seen more of that than I've seen Grimm. I didn't get very far into Grimm.
I had problems with some early seasons of Grimm for reasons that you will share. Can we put a link to the Derek and Stiles Pride and Prejudice video in the show notes?
By all means.
Excellent.
Yes, no problem. Good. I have one other thing I want to mention, which I thought whilst we were recording, and that is Clive Barker's Cabal, which was made into the film Nightbreed. It's not obviously anyone's a werewolf, but the character of Peliquin is so obviously a werewolf, and indeed Cabal, or Boone, is also a werewolf, having been bitten by Peliquin and infected with Peliquin's venom. And the idea is that Peliquin has a sort of semi-human form, but to become the beast, he breathes out this spiritual form that then becomes this monstrous form around him. And that's when he turns into something that is the beast. Meat for the beast is what
sounds
he says.
Sounds pretty werewolfy to me.
It is. And I think it's sort of looking those as a bunch of the inhabitants of Midian as a bunch of werewolves, albeit weird looking ones, who are basically trying to live apart from humanity and control their bestial nature by accepting it, is kind of an interesting setup. And I think makes for one of Clive Barker's best early novels. Certainly a lot shorter than things like Weave World. But that's a different story. Okay, then I think we're done.
Yep.
So thank you so much to Liz.
Thank you.
And Becky.
Thank you.
And that's our podcast. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you've got comments, we'd love to hear them. We're on the web and on social media. Details at fictoplasm.net. Until next time, bye.